Yes, Elon Musk wants to take the human race to Mars. How about first, though, he builds us a car we can afford, huh? From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Monday, July 3rd. Glad to have you here, as we always are, everybody. Today, in the category of audacious promises, we bring you, and not for the first time in this category either, by the by, Tesla CEO Elon Musk. Musk has a history of being bold, shall we say, with his pronouncements, so take what I'm about to tell you with a suitable degree of skepticism. Late last night, Musk announced via tweet, of course, because that's how business and policy get done in this day and age, that the long-awaited mass-market Tesla Model 3 is on track, his words, to begin full production this week with the first deliveries by the end of the month. $35,000 sticker price, by the way, is how Tesla defines mass market. But the upshot is this. We are on track from a man known for overpromising, but maybe sort of possibly could be at a tipping point for large-scale adoption of affordable zero-emission electric vehicles, which, it's important to remember here, have not been exactly flying out of the showrooms. From the Sustainability Desk, Marketplace's Scott Tong reports.
The dawn of the electric car age has been proclaimed many times since the turn of the century. That is 1900. So, is this Tesla really a turning point now? Sam Jaffe at Cairn Energy Research Advisors says yes. It's not so much the Model 3 goes 200 miles or it looks fancy, or even that 400,000 customers have pre-ordered it. It's the $35,000 sticker price.
If the car manufacturers can quickly find out ways to reduce the cost of making these vehicles, they will be much more popular. You will have to start seeing economy cars, meaning $20,000 to $25,000 price point.
Which he sees in 5 to 10 years. And overall, he sees plug-in vehicles to jump from 1% of U.S. sales to 12% in a decade. That's a conservative forecast. The French state oil company, yes, an oil company, predicts up to 30% penetration by 2030. Now, a big reason for the affordability is a revolution in cheaper batteries.
The battery itself, that problem has been solved. It's the other parts of the car at this point that are costing too much.
Another huge factor is policy. California and 7 other states have mandates to get more zero-emissions vehicles, or ZEVs, on the road. Independent auto analyst Alan Baum.
You would otherwise see most automakers looking from the sidelines to say, well, we'll wait until it gets to be a big deal. But they can't do that because of the ZEV regulations.
Not to mention federal tax credits. And that's just regulations in the U.S. Other incentives in places like China to buy Teslas and other electric vehicles aim to boost EVs enough to dent world oil demand in the next decade or two. I'm Scott Tong for Marketplace.
Qatar, tiny in population but oh so rich in natural gas reserves, has until Wednesday to meet a list of demands its neighbors in the Middle East released today. Saudi Arabia, the United Arab Emirates, Egypt, and Bahrain all cut ties with Qatar last month, accusing it of supporting terrorism. There's a list of 13 demands those countries want to see met before they will lift a land and sea blockade. Among them, that Qatar close down its state-supported news network Al Jazeera. What is it about that particular media company that so irritates other Middle Eastern countries? Marketplace's Jed Kim has that one.
Despite its small size, Qatar has attracted the eyes of the Arab world through news.
Al Jazeera has put Qatar on the map in ways that no one would have imagined, given its size.
Shibli Telhami teaches at the University of Maryland. He says Al Jazeera is a key part of Qatar's identity, giving it the ability to punch above its weight because of its wide global audience.
To imagine that this is now going to be eliminated is essentially to imagine that Qatar will play a far smaller role in the Middle East and around the world.
The four countries demanding Al Jazeera's end have despised it for decades, says John Sfakianakis. He's with the Gulf Research Center in Dubai. He says those nations object to the network giving voice to a wide spectrum of views. Also, they don't like the viewpoint.
Al Jazeera channel criticized the rest of the Arab world, but it never criticized Qatar.
Others say the channel serves to keep Arab governments from manipulating narratives. Al Jazeera itself recently released a video making its own demands.
We demand journalists aren't treated as criminals.
We demand press freedom.
Al Jazeera's legacy is revolutionizing information sharing in the Arab world. Joel Rubin teaches at Carnegie Mellon and was a former Deputy Assistant Secretary of State. He says it created an appetite that's unlikely to go away.
If they were to shut down Al Jazeera tomorrow, it's not as if the Arab world would no longer want to hear the kinds of reporting and the kinds of opinion that Al Jazeera is providing. Something new will pop up.
Though many think it's unlikely Qatar would kill Al Jazeera, some fear concessions could take away some of its bite. I'm Jed Kim for Marketplace.
Wall Street today, short session, so traders could get out of town ahead of the holiday tomorrow. They made the most of things while they were there, though. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Mixed in with the millions of people starting college this fall will be some unknown number of undocumented students who are going to be the first in their families to get a higher education. And they will be entering a phase of their lives that could change the course of their economic futures. First-generation kids already face a particular set of challenges and decisions when it comes to college. But for undocumented students, the recent crackdown on illegal immigration has added something new to their mix. Marketplace's Rima Kreis has this story of two of those students and the decisions they've made.
Carlos, now 17, grew up in Huntington Park, a largely Latino neighborhood near Los Angeles. And many of his childhood memories were made along this stretch of Pacific Boulevard.
We were all kind of raised coming here.
He'd come with his family to buy groceries, eat Mexican food at their favorite local restaurants, shop.
That was a big one right there, Valles Paradis. When we were younger, that's where you would go get your uniform for school, just because, I mean, you know, they have a lot of...
Super cheap.
And it's a lot like of really, cheap. Like, basically uniform types of clothing.
That was Carlos's brother, Jose, chiming in. This year, Carlos came to this street to prepare for school in a different way, to choose a college, or have one choose him.
I've come here a lot for interviews for colleges. I had my Princeton interview here.
Here is Tierra Mia, a coffee shop where Carlos would meet with alums from different schools to put a face on all of his accomplishments. Student body president, founder of the Mock Trial Club, preschool and Planned Parenthood volunteer, distance runner, and of course, straight A's. So, where did he get in?
Princeton, Columbia, Yale, Harvard. I think that's it. Yeah, I think that's it.
Yeah, that's it for the Ivies, plus seven California schools.
UCLA, UC Santa Barbara, UC Santa Cruz.
So Carlos considered academics, financial aid, moving hundreds of miles away from his family. And in the end, one thing tipped the balance. He wanted a school
where you can be kind of safe and be able to just focus on your studies rather than focus on whether or not you might not be there the next day or something.
Might not be there the next day, as in being detained or deported. Carlos was born in Mexico and is undocumented, which is why we're only using his first name.
It's so unpredictable at these times that having that type of protection in a campus, like being a sanctuary campus, is really reassuring.
Carlos will be going to Yale. Campus police there aren't allowed to ask about immigration status, and the school has vowed to support undocumented students if they need legal help. And his brother is already there, so Carlos knows his parents won't worry as much. But he says he'll worry about them.
At any time I'm over there, something might happen to my parents. And it's something you have to just kind of keep in the back of your head all the time.
18-year-old Martha knows the feeling. That's why she's sticking close to home in San Diego.
This is my living room. It's a pretty small apartment, but...
Martha, who was also born in Mexico and is undocumented, shows me the two-bedroom apartment she lives with her parents and younger siblings. She points out her room.
As you can see, it's very pink.
Super pink, down to the bunk bed Martha shares with her little sister, and it's where she'll keep sleeping when she starts college in the fall at San Diego State University.
I feel like I should be home, and like I always have that weight on my shoulders, like guilt. My mom needs me right now.
Martha's mom, Nancy, is a housekeeper. She says she's been afraid to leave the apartment since the election.
Because she's scared that at whatever place they could retain her and take her away. She doesn't have a life outside home and work.
So Martha runs errands, gets the groceries. There was a time when she felt she shouldn't even think about going to college.
Que pudieran estudiar y realizarse.
But her mom says she wants Martha to have what she couldn't, an education.
Like, I can't just give up now or else everything they did for us would be, like, useless.
She wants to study math.
Calculus was amazing for me. So just to keep going is going to be, like, mind-blowing.
Meanwhile, Carlos was thinking of studying physics at Yale, but thermodynamics, fluid mechanics have become more of a hobby lately. Political science, on the other hand.
I think if you would ask me, like, 3 years ago, if I would have been interested, I would have been like, no, because I always hated politics.
But he says the election made him realize his community needs a stronger voice.
I kind of saw the struggles that we had as like a group of people as in terms of being undocumented, and maybe I could do something to help change that.
And isn't change what college is supposed to be all about? I'm Rima Crace for Marketplace.
Those looking to make six-figure salaries probably don't have Lumberyard at the top of their list, but maybe they ought to. The building supply company 84 Lumber has openings for skilled construction workers and managers who can make that much. Management trainees start at $40,000 a year. Top managers at the biggest stores can earn up to $1 million. Prashant Gopal wrote about 84 Lumber and stores like it for Bloomberg Business Week. Welcome to the program.
Great to be here.
This is a story really about the relative value of a college education versus learning a trade, right?
It is, yes. I mean, I think there's sort of a feeling that the only path to success in America is through college. And there are plenty of jobs right now that are unfilled, blue-collar jobs that don't require a college education.
Tell me about 84 Lumber, the company you focus on in this piece.
So 84 Lumber is one of the largest building supply chains in the country. And it was sort of a little-known company until their Super Bowl ad this year, which focused on a mother and daughter and their journey through Mexico to a big border wall that blocked them until they found a large wooden door that was presumably built with materials from 84 Lumber. And that was sort of the beginning of a campaign to try to get young people mm-hmm. come and work there.
This campaign that 84 Lumber is running, and I guess other companies as well, are they working? I mean, are people going to work at 84 Lumber and the rest of them?
At 84 Lumber, they say that their talent pool has gotten a lot better. But I spoke with someone who had $100,000 in debt after graduating with a finance degree from Temple. Oh. He tried to get a job at a hedge fund or a bank, and he didn't have any experience, so nobody would hire him. But 84 Lumber will take people without experience, and they'll train them because there aren't enough people with that sort of training. This is an avenue for even some folks with college degrees.
It's worth a note here that President Trump has thrown some more money into this idea of apprenticeships, right? This kind of vocational skills-based learning.
Yeah, it's very timely. Everybody's kind of pushing high school kids to go to college. I mean, the whole system now used to be more of a track system until the early 80s, where you could work in, I think, what was called shop. You know, you could learn about how to fix a car or, you know, be a plumber, all those sorts of things. And that vanished. I mean, you have classes here or there, but it's not really a program. So people come out of high school, most try college, half of them drop out. Yeah. And they're left with nothing to show for it but debt. And they're not prepared for these many blue-collar jobs. There are a lot of them in construction, for example. And, with a little training, some of these people could take those jobs.
It has to be said that in the long run, you're better off economically if you have a college degree. Not only do you make more money, but also in the short term, the unemployment rate for college-educated Americans is far, far lower.
Yeah, I mean, colleges still have a story to sell. There was a study that over a lifetime, a college four-year degree is worth about $830,000 more than a high school diploma. So there are arguments on both sides, of course. Mm-hmm. There are a lot of people with college degrees now competing for some of the most competitive jobs out there, and some of them are ending up applying for jobs at 84 Lumber.
Prashant Gopal, he covers the housing industry for Bloomberg Business. Prashant, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Coming up...
He said, I own Weber, the grill company.
Oh, well, fine then. A meeting with barbecue royalty. Straight ahead, but first, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrial's up 129 points today, 0.6%, ended at 21,479. NASDAQ down 30 points, about 0.4%, 6110. S&P 500 up 5 points, 0.2%, finished at 2429. Banks rebounded on higher interest rates and increased bond yields. Capital One up 1.1%. Wells Fargo up 0.2% today. The financial services company Bankrate appreciated 8.5% today. It's agreed to be bought by data services firm Red Ventures for $1.25 billion. It's always about the data. Electric car maker Tesla initially rose but closed down 2.4% today. Therein lies the skepticism about Mr. Musk that we told you about. Bond prices fell. Yield on the 10-year T-note rose to 2.34%. Don't forget, markets close tomorrow. You're listening to Marketplace.
This Marketplace podcast is supported by Gusto. Let your employees know you've got their back by signing up for Gusto for payroll and HR. More than 300,000 small business owners use Gusto. They offer benefits like health insurance, employee onboarding, and more. Get your payroll taxes filed, deductions calculated, and your team paid fast. No more pain. Just the joy of running your business. Get 3 months free when you go to gusto.com/marketplace. That's gusto.com/marketplace.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. One hates to be the one to turn the conversation to schools here at the very height of summer vacation, but sadly, policy waits for nobody. School choice is a top priority for the new Secretary of Education, Betsy DeVos, and charter schools are one pillar of that choice. But as charters, publicly funded but independent schools, become more popular, it's become apparent that the choice isn't being equally applied and that that is resegregating some school districts. Georgia Public Broadcasting's Grant Blankenship reports now on one possible solution.
All right, eighth grade is next.
Parents play the charter school admissions lottery every year. That's what I'm watching at the Academy for Classical Education Charter School in Macon, Georgia. ACE, for short. Here, every student has even odds. But now all the open seats are gone. Sammy Smith is back for another year just to see where his daughters land on the waiting list.
They're in Springdale now, which is decent, but we just like the classical education better.
Actually, Springdale Elementary, a traditional school, outperforms the charter school academically. But about a quarter of the white students in this majority black school district go to ACE. It's a district where half of all the elementary schools are considered failing by the state, and 40% of students live below the poverty line. So when charter school principal Laura Perkins walks in, I ask her, how does ACE help those students go to school here?
We don't have anything, any control over that.
But aren't charters about choice for students in tough schools?
Right, but the charter rules don't allow you to do any of that.
Turns out, charters here do have a way to give those kids a boost.
I see this as a no-brainer to use.
That's Matt Underwood, executive director of the Atlanta Neighborhood Charter School in the gentrifying Grant Park neighborhood. He's talking about a weighted admissions lottery, something that became legal in Georgia over a year ago. Weighted lotteries allow charter schools to give better numerical odds to disadvantaged students. So instead of a kid's name being entered once, it can be entered up to five times. Underwood says it's a tool to fight racial segregation since race often correlates with poverty, although waiting for race alone is not an option.
I personally don't think it really gives charter schools a good name if you see this sort of discrepancy in the demographics of students in schools that are right around each other.
Atlanta Neighborhood Charter gave economically disadvantaged kids four times better odds of getting into kindergarten this year. That more than doubled the number of kindergartners coming from poverty. Weighted lotteries aren't mandatory in Georgia, but of the 80 or so schools that could use this, only one other has done so. But you don't have to look hard around the state to see where the system might work elsewhere. Over in Savannah, blacks are twice as likely to live in poverty as whites, but the Tybee Island Maritime Academy Charter School there is 80% white. In Greene County, up north, blacks are three times as likely to live in poverty, but the area's Lake Oconee charter is 79% white. Brian Beabout says there is a name for schools like this.
People have called those white flight academies, that they are simply ways for middle class populations to sort of create a publicly financed private school.
Beabout is an educational leadership professor at the University of New Orleans. He's supportive of charter schools, and of course he says not every charter school is a white flight academy, but if the shoe fits...
I think they ought to face some public pressure. Is there public will to move in one direction or the other?
Good morning.
Good morning.
How are you?
I'm doing all right.
About a month after the ACE lottery, I returned to talk with the school's principal, Laura Perkins, about the idea of giving poor kids better odds of getting through the front door.
It's not my job to say you need it more than I need it.
Still, she says she might look at a weighted lottery.
What do you think?
We'll run it past the governing board and give it a whirl.
And of course, parents could ask for it when the Academy for Classical Education's charter comes up for review in 2 years. In Macon, Georgia, I'm Grant Blankenship for Marketplace.
According to the people who track this stuff, and there are people who track this stuff, the 4th of July is the biggest grilling day of the year. So, for today's installment of our series, Summer, brought to you by some of the history of Weber Grills, the product and the company that helped popularize backyard barbecuing.
Imagination.
Wonderful products.
Brought to you by...
Mike Kempster calls himself Weber's brand godfather. He started out as a store product demonstrator back in 1971. He's been the chief marketing officer for the company as well. Thanks for coming on the program.
Yes, it's great to be here today.
Tell me how you wound up at Weber Lothies many years ago.
I was working for a retailer in the Chicago area named Montgomery Ward at the time. And there was a gentleman that was looking at a tractor. And you get a man on a tractor and it's half sold. And so we brought a tractor out, cut a few swaths of grass. And then as I was closing the sale, I looked up and there were a lot of Weber grills on this man's balcony. And I said, my goodness, you must be a real professional barbecuer. And he said, no, he said, I own Weber, the grill company. And his name was George Steven, and it's Weber Steven Company is the official name of the company.
It originally was, Mr. Steven, what did he do? He cut some, like, metal buoys in half? Is that the deal?
Yes, he worked at a company that was located not too far from here on Illinois Street called Weber Brothers Metalwork. And they were spinning two shapes that would be welded together to form a buoy for the Chicago Yacht Club. So he got the idea, maybe I could put some legs on this thing and maybe it would work a lot better than the grills in those days if it had a lid so the wind wouldn't blow ashes around and so forth. And, well, as the story goes, he took it home to his suburban home in Mount Prospect, Illinois. And he and a neighbor lit it and tried to use it, and it didn't work. And another neighbor said, hey, guys, you got to knock some holes in the top and bottom of that thing and let some air in. So they did, and the Weber barbecue was fired up for the first time, and, well, it's been going ever since. That was 1952.
And here's the deal, though. I mean, grilling is ubiquitous now, right? I mean, it's everywhere, and it's hard to imagine a time when this market was new. You know what I mean?
Well, I understand that because when I first joined the company in 1971, barbecuing was a pretty amateurish thing in those days where you had just open braziers and it was, you know, it was pretty primitive back then. So it's hard to imagine that now, but it's taken a long time to, you know, build a barbecue culture around the world.
You have traveled the world, I imagine, as a brand ambassador for Weber. What's your craziest international grill story?
Oh, I guess the craziest one I would have would be when I was in Cape Town, South Africa, and I was demonstrating Weber grills on a Saturday, and a gentleman came up, and we were talking about barbecuing, and he said, well, this 22.5-inch kettle, will it roast a warthog leg, a leg of warthog? And, you know, I had limited knowledge in terms of animals in South Africa. And when he said warthog, I thought hedgehog. And I'm thinking, you know, hedgehogs aren't that big. Who would ever want to roast a leg of hedgehog? Well, I had to consult with a woman in South Africa that was a cookbook author, and she assured me that a roasted leg of warthog is pretty darn good. And we included a recipe in our first South African cookbook.
Mike Kempster, he's at Weber, has been for a number of years. Mike, thanks so much.
You're welcome, Kai. It's a pleasure, and thank you for having me.
There are more of Mike's stories from the early days at Weber featured in a new recipe book. It's called Weber's Greatest Hits. We will put one of them, the recipes, that is, and sadly, no, not the warthog one, although we probably should have, up at marketplace.org. This final note on the way out today, we're going to file this one under everything's perfectly all right. Nobody be alarmed. The Federal Reserve revealed today that Chair Janet Yellen was hospitalized while in London over the weekend. She'd been there for a conference last week, stayed to take a couple of days vacation with her family. It was a urinary tract infection, the Fed said. She is on her way back to Washington and work this week. All right, we got to go. The Dow up 129 points today, 0.6%. NASDAQ down 30 points, 0.4%. S&P 500 up 5, 0.2%. Our daily production team includes Bridget Bodner, Robert Garoba, Jenny Josephson, and Daisy Palacios. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. I got the day off. Adrian Hill is going to be here. Think about what it means tomorrow, would you? All right. Got to go. Bye. This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.